Chapter 8. Gnostics and Rosicrucians. If you are to grasp the full import of this discourse on Gnostics and Rosicrucians, it is important to take a completely objective and unprejudiced point of view. For centuries, all of Western mankind has been driven deliberately into mistaken concepts of Gnosticism and Rosicrucianism. As a result of this deception, the majority have been severed from all contact with the universal doctrine and have become willless victims of various world powers. Those who, out of an inner urge, have tried to re-establish a link with the universal truth are severely impeded in their efforts by an encapsulated consciousness and by an unintentional prejudice which arises from their blood. All who have sought the path to the higher life can tell you of the tremendous exertion it has cost, the boundless difficulties to be overcome, the countless detours which had to be made in order to free themselves from the fate of the blood, from the poison bequeathed to their consciousness by many generations of ancestors. In fact, complete objectivity is impossible. That is why the beginning pupil is always advised, if his longing for the light is sufficiently deep, to push aside his blood prejudices. The insight gained will then strengthen him for a successful struggle against all that the past has etched into his blood and consciousness. The current opinion about Gnostics is that, at the beginning of our era, certain individuals and groups attempted to inject all sorts of pagan customs, rites, and doctrines into the Christian teachings, that an intense struggle was fought by the young church to rid itself of all these contaminations, and that for some centuries now Gnosticism has been a thing of the past. What is commonly thought, taught, and said about the Rosicrucians is probably known to you. Officially, Rosicrucianism dates back to about the 13th or 14th century. It is claimed that the Rosicrucians practiced the natural sciences in secret because their practice was forbidden by the church. Chemistry, astrology, medicine, geology, cosmology, and allied subjects were the sciences most commonly practiced. Two lines of development could be clearly distinguished in this Rosicrucianism: the physical and the metaphysical, the cultural and the evolutionary. We find the descendants of this Rosicrucianism in two races: the cultural stream in the Germanic race, manifesting itself, for example, in the anthroposophical movement, and the evolutionary stream in the Anglo-Saxon race, taking form in, among other things, the theosophical movement. Both groups try to effect a liberation of the world and mankind in, through, and with nature, the one emphasizing the cultural and the other laying greater stress on the metaphysical element. As a result, the one is more materialistic, the other more spiritualistic in character. It is not surprising, therefore, that spiritualism has become so widespread in Anglo-Saxon countries. One might easily classify historical Rosicrucianism, anthroposophy and theosophy and all their branches under one heading, without adding or detracting from any of them. If the followers of Steiner, Besant, Tingley, Spencer Lewis, or Max Heindel call themselves Rosicrucians, they have a perfect right to do so. If they accuse each other of imitation or plagiarism, they are entirely correct because, without exception, they all spring from the same roots. We can only sigh and say what a pity it is that all the fragments and effects of that exploded 13th century grenade did not remain united. History might have been quite different in many respects. For the sake of completeness, we must add that Freemasonry, as it has been known for the past few centuries, also stems from the same roots. If you study these things further, you will probably realize that there must be another Gnosticism, another Rosicrucianism, and, if we may say so, another Freemasonry than the ones known to you. If you have made this discovery, you will never again mention the modern Rosicross, which dates back to August 1924, in the same breath as the cultural and metaphysical forms of esotericism mentioned above. The Gnosticism, Rosicrucianism, and Freemasonry to which we refer, and which we are trying to interpret, are three designations for one and the same universal stream, a stream that knows neither age nor youth, which simply was, is, and shall be throughout all eternity. This stream is sometimes called Gnostic because of its philosophical character, sometimes Rosicrucian because of its Christ-centered character, and it is sometimes identified with Freemasonry because of its constructing and actualizing character. This stream, which emanates from the Universal Brotherhood, has as its universal distinguishing feature an absolute rejection of any nature-physical or nature-metaphysical goals, and represents solely a transfiguristic philosophy, therefore Gnosticism, a Christ-centered confession that can in no way be associated with this nature, hence Rosicrucianism, and a methodical, scientifically applied course of development which breaks down everything of this nature and builds what is of the original divine nature, therefore Freemasonry. The Universal Brotherhood establishes neither societies nor churches. From time to time, it calls schools into existence in order to help all those who, in certain respects, are united in insight and therefore Gnostic, united in their confession and therefore Rosicrucian, united in striving and therefore Masons. As soon as a pupil's insight, confession, and striving deviate in any way, the Universal Brotherhood releases the one concerned without delay, for retaining him would damage the work of construction, or would even constitute exploitation if, for example, a pupil were kept on because of his social status. We should like to mention yet another clearly recognizable sign, namely, that such threefold transfiguristic work will always meet with hostility, coming mainly from two directions, from the church and from the occult streams. There has never been open political hostility, nor is this expected in the future. The pupils of the Universal Brotherhood are quiet, peaceful citizens who do not concern themselves with political, social, or economic activities, who do not wish to attract attention, and who prefer to be left alone. They have no worldly aspirations except to dissociate themselves from matter as quickly as possible. Animosity on the part of the church becomes dangerous to the pupil only when the church becomes involved in exercising political power. History has taught that, under such circumstances, all transfigurists are in immediate danger of their lives. The same danger exists if occult streams become politically powerful. All religious freedom, freedom of speech, and of the press are then revoked at once, as an introduction to all that follows. For this reason, it is certain that every sustained transfiguristic endeavor is a way of the cross, not only in the liberating sense, but also in the earthly sense. In this way also, the pupil bears kinship to Christ. Our era is marked by three great transfiguristic movements: that of the Gnostics at the beginning of our era, that of the Manichaeans who originated directly from the Gnostics, and that of the Cathars. A fourth movement is now in the process of development. Between these great movements, the work never ceased, but was dispersed, and always continued on a small scale. In every century, notable workers were actively practicing this royal art. Karl von Eckartshausen, for example, at the end of the 18th century, and Johann Valentin Andrea in the 17th. However, the writings left behind by these workers have been badly distorted by the twofold classical enemy. That is another signature of which you should take note. All the literature of transfiguristic movements has either disappeared or may still be found in just a few libraries in a distorted or very veiled form. Mani was murdered in the year 2177, chiefly at the instigation of Persian occultists. The later brotherhood of the Manichaeans spread over the whole of Asia Minor, Africa, and Southern Europe during the 4th century. They survived until the 6th century, but thousands of them were then murdered at the direction of the Christian bishops, the church, and the Persian magicians. Their literature was destroyed as far as possible. The nucleus of this brotherhood withdrew to the Brotherhood of Shambhala in the Gobi Desert. The Cathars, too, fared the same, and so it will go in the future, as long as this dialectical nature order continues to exist. The noble threefold transfiguristic craft of insight, professing, and striving passes like a breath from the heart of the Gobi over the entire world. It is withdrawn, only to be sent out anew. It does not struggle. It works. It does not fight. And yet it triumphs. All opposition only accentuates the ultimate victory. Finally, we want to show you the transfiguristic character of the classical gnosis by means of a short explanation. May this lead to your sharing with us the universal insight, to your sealing the universal confession in your heart's blood and bringing to reality the universal striving, so that together we may prove to be true Gnostics, true Rosicrucians, and true Freemasons. The classical gnosis is the direct servant of the universal brotherhood. It always steps to the forefront in world history, immediately after every fresh impulse of the great universal teachers. In the wake of such an impulse, it is the task of the Gnostics to propagate among those who are receptive, deeper insight into the inner coherence of the true, original life. That is why the world has known many Gnostic systems which, although differing externally, were in essence the same and fulfilled the same calling. So, when we speak of Christian Gnosticism, there is no question of a new philosophy, but of a renewed philosophy, a renewed gnosis. In other words, the one ancient, imperishable message, which has been brought into accord with the new universal impulse. The new impulse must be preserved as a living, vibrating reality for as long as possible. That is the essential, fundamental task of the Gnostics. To preserve and to disseminate the divine impulse as a force and to revivify it again and again. When we reflect on this, we are transported in spirit to a wonderful and gigantic battle scene. We see in our mind's eye the great and terrible struggle between the Universal Brotherhood and what has been called the God of this world, or the Prince of this world. The God of this world is not destroyed during a cosmic revolution, but his field of work is emptied, in a manner of speaking. He is deprived of his prey. When a new day of manifestation dawns, all entities who are once more subject to the turning of the wheel possess a free choice. Hence, mankind at large becomes the object of a struggle between the Universal Brotherhood and the God of this world. The God of this world is a hierarchy of many mighty entities. In Gnostic philosophy, they are termed aeons. These aeons are parasites, maintaining themselves as long as there are people whom they can parasitize. They exploit the masses and use them like a great herd of cattle. They live on the etheric, astral, and spinal forces of the masses. As soon as the masses are won for the new life, the kingdom and power of the aeons must also come to an end. All holy language gives detailed, albeit veiled, information on this. The dramatic, terrible life of the aeons must fill us with horror. They maintain themselves in the reflection sphere, and that is their prison. Their loathsome activity always causes tremendous atmospheric and geological upheaval. More and more entities are being drawn away from their sphere of action and led into eternal freedom, as the continuing impulses of the Universal Brotherhood constantly gather new harvests. The aeons are becoming increasingly weaker, and since to them too time is an illusion, and 1,000 years are but as one day, they stand under the eternal judgment of the words, "Even now the axe is laid to the root of the tree." It is important to understand clearly the struggle between the Elohim and the aeons. It is not a matter of black and white hosts ranged against one another, as mystic artists would have us believe. No, the warriors meet each other in the object of their interest. The encounter takes place in the human heart, in the essence of the blood, in the nerve fluid, in the human consciousness, and in the place where we live, the world. Let us suppose that the Elohim are radiating a new redeeming impulse over the world, and let us call that impulse the manifestation of Jesus Christ. Then the Gnostics will be active in inking that impulse with humanity as deeply and widely as possible. The aeons accede to this impulse. They pretend to cooperate while trying to make the impulse serve the maintenance of the dialectical nature order. In this way, the nature physical and the nature metaphysical rays develop, as well as the rays of natural religion, giving rise to the various occult and ecclesiastical trends. These trends are designed to block the spiritual stream of the Universal Brotherhood in the human organism. Ecclesiastical and occult magic spring from one and the same source, from the hierarchy of the aeons. Thus, it is entirely understandable that the Christian bishops, as servants of the Aeons, are the declared enemies of all Gnosticism, and that they go hand in hand with the occultists to curtail, or if possible exterminate, every Gnostic development. So, from time to time, the world experiences an extremely gruesome masquerade. Under the guise of exaltedness and in the name of Jesus Christ, as previously in the names of many earlier divine messengers, millions are taken captive by the Aeons and rendered immune to the divine touch, until these violated beings can be offered a new chance of salvation after a cosmic revolution. There is no one more Christian, more pious, humane, and loving than the Aeons and their servants. But one will be able to recognize them immediately by their behavior and aim. For them, it is essential that our eye consciousness be maintained, for that is the essence of what binds us to dialectics. In addition, they try to keep the masses ignorant, for an ignorant group lends itself particularly well to magical exploitation. If the individual wants development, then there is occultism. However, the Aeons view a development of this kind with envy, insofar as the occult path irrevocably leads to the pupil himself becoming an Aeon. Almost the entire New Testament, in contrast to the Old, is a Gnostic Testament. The Gnosis is averse to the greater part of the Old Testament because of its occult aspects and the strongly racial emphases, which are interwoven with the universal message. These can give rise to many dangers, as has been amply proved. Especially names in the Old Testament, as symbols of Kabbalistic formulae, can, by and large, very easily bring about occult connections, and hence overshadowing. So we are placing you before the imperishable Gnosis, which has, as its starting point, the idea that the divine spirit is held captive in the world of the senses, and that, consequently, it is necessary to rise up out of this prison, out of this imprisoned soul man. In this way, the original spirit man can be united with the primary source of all things, by means of insight, professing, and striving. In the school of the Golden Rosicross, you are confronted with the universal insight. The vibrating living reality of the universal brotherhood surges over and around you in order to make a Rosicrucian of you, to make you profess the universal insight until your whole being is aglow with it, and it becomes your down-sitting and your uprising, until it engrosses you so that you cannot be separated from it by day or by night, and you profess it completely. And this is a pain, a deep despair, and great loneliness, for insight and professing have entered the soul being who is not of God, and has therefore become completely stranded in his efforts to return to the Father. But now, in this helplessness, in this suffering, this downfall, this broken state, another school stands ready, the school of higher consciousness, to enable you to tread the path of redemption through rightly directed striving, building, and breaking. So we place before you this threefold liberating goal, as to insight, a Gnostic, and as to professing, or a Rosicrucian, or as to striving, a Freemason. Whoever bears this threefold aim as the signature of their being has been kindled by the Spirit of God, raised to insight, died in Jesus the Lord on the way of the cross as one who professes, reborn through the Holy Spirit as a striving and building victor.